From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage. People around the country are participating in protests against police brutality and racism after the death of George Floyd. Some of the demonstrations have turned violent, both with property destruction and looting, and the police response with tear gas and other suppression tactics. Some journalists have been detained while reporting on the events, even. It raises plenty of legal questions. To help us sort it out, we were joined by Neil Fulton. He's the dean of the University of South Dakota School of Law.
Dean Fulton, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for the opportunity, Jackie. Glad to be here.
So we're going to get to some of the legal questions around protesting and other demonstrations that we're seeing. But first, I want to start with some of the potential solutions to the issue that Governor Noem pointed out. I think it was last week in a press conference. And one of those being reconsidering this idea of qualified immunity. And I imagine a lot of folks may not know off the top of their head just what that means. Can you explain qualified immunity to us?
Yeah, qualified immunity is a doctrine that recognizes for certain types of public officials, in particular police, that your actions can't give rise to liability unless they violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights. Now, the reason that doctrine was created was you have public officials who have to make either decisions in the moment, like police, or decisions in areas where there's great discretion and lack of clarity, like elected officials. And so we want to give them some room for honest mistakes. Where, you know, you really hear people having trouble with the doctrine of qualified immunity right now is this idea of what's a clearly established right. The courts of appeals across the country haven't achieved perfect clarity on that. And in some instances, there have been courts that have said it's got to be exactly the conduct that the officer engaged in. I heard the example the other day of the use of a police dog, and that if it wasn't in exactly the same physical location as had been addressed before, qualified immunity applied. And I think that's where people really start to have problems with the doctrine.
Right. What if we were to say not lean on qualified immunity anymore as it comes to police actions, I know we're dealing in hypotheticals with that, of course, but what do we risk or what do we see if we don't have qualified immunity?
Well, I mean, certainly one of the things you have is that law enforcement agencies and individual law enforcement officers are subject to a greater degree of liability. That can be addressed in a lot of ways. South Dakota, for example, self-insures its state and local officers, and the state would have to assess just the financial cost of that. But there's also the impact on does it make officers in settings that are unclear hesitate to act in instances that make people unsafe? Mm. Clearly, the flip side of that is in some of the instances where qualified immunity is out there and very robustly enforced, it's leading officers to act with impunity. I mean, I think we're seeing examples of that where people are pointing to officers who their perception is don't really feel scared or responsible for their actions. And I think striking that balance, if we're going to reassess qualified immunity by statute, is going to be the real challenge.
Another thing kind of being reassessed in many ways right now is even the existence of a police force. Some Minneapolis City Council members are committing to vote to disband the police department there. Tell us a little bit about kind of the statutory angle on that. Are we legally required to have a police force?
No. I mean, there's nothing that would require us to have a police force, fire department, other entities that provide public safety. Those are choices we make as a society, in fact, create by statute or ordinance. What you've seen in a lot of instances where people are talking about, quote, disband the police, close quote, I think in a lot of instances probably more accurately described as re-envision or restructure the police. One of the most prominent examples is Camden, New Jersey, that a few years ago actually did disband by ordinance its police force. What it then did is work with the county and surrounding areas to develop a new regional policing entity that had greater financial resources, greater training opportunities, greater coordination. And when it disbanded, it let all of its officers go and the vast majority were rehired. So I think for a lot of folks, there's a discussion about disband, maybe reassess, restructure. And I think for some of the protesters that are out there talking about disband, some of them are also talking about re-envision. Can you have different priorities of what we ask police to do? In many instances, police are frontline folks to deal with mental health issues, to deal with addiction issues. Are there ways to restructure those responsibilities and give them to counselors or addiction advocates who may be better aligned to dealing with those things? Certainly, there are some protesters right now who it appear are just so frustrated and angry that they're really just saying disband the police. But I think that that conversation at a policy level is really talking about restructuring or re-envisioning policing.
Right. And it sounds to me this will largely come down to a very localized decisions. Am I understanding that right?
Absolutely. Law enforcement is really a very localized thing. I mean, individual municipalities make decisions about their law enforcement. They make decisions about how their police is structured, how their police is trained. I think one thing that you see in South Dakota that I really think is better is there's a lot of coordination about our training. There's a lot of centralized training through the Department of Criminal Investigation and the Law Enforcement Training Center. And so we get a lot of our local police forces on the same page about best practices and safety and community engagement, but those are still local decisions that individual municipalities make.
I want to shift our conversation now back to kind of the legality surrounding protests and large assemblies like that. Just kind of to kick us off, what do you think people need to understand about their legal rights to protest that maybe aren't so clear to the average person who's wanting to get involved right now?
Yeah, I mean, not so clear is true for the legal experts, too, because this is really an interesting question that's at the heart of First Amendment law, which is, you know, the division between speech and action. If you go read the First Amendment, it talks about make no law prohibiting speech. And the same is true in our state constitution. But the reality is a lot of the things that we protect under the First Amendment aren't strictly speaking speech. We protect a lot of expressive actions. Burning a flag is protected. Writing is not strictly speaking speech, but it's clearly protected under the First Amendment. So I think one of the key things that people have to realize out there is one of the things that's going to be in play is when action that's expressive crosses over and is no longer protected speech. And I think the easiest way to think about that is if you are out truly trying to communicate, if you are marching, if you are carrying banners, if you are chanting, those are expressive protected acts of speech. But it crosses the line when we move into violence or destruction of property. Those are actions that simply aren't protected. And I think that's the real dividing line for folks out there, is the right to peaceable assembly and expression is what's going to be protected. Violence and property destruction don't have legal protection.
Right. And that touches into my next question. We're hearing the word riot thrown around. And when we talk about property destruction and other things like that, that would be probably included in what we imagine as a riot. Is there like a lawful definition of when a protest turns into a riot, or is it based on the individual actions that happen?
Yeah. So in South Dakota, there is law on this, and the place you'd want to go in the South Dakota Code is chapter 22-10. That specifically deals with riot. And we define riot as when three or more people get together without legal authority and either use force or violence or engage in the threats of force of violence with the immediate ability to carry them out. So if you have a group of three or more people who are together and they start engaging in property damage or they start engaging in physical violence towards other people, you have crossed the line from protest and expression into riot and criminal activity. Along the same lines, one thing that people need to know in that chapter is a peaceful protest that engages with law enforcement or other public safety officials. There is a provision at 22-10-11 that talks about intentionally disobeying a reasonable public safety order to move, disperse, or refrain from specific activities. So if you have, for example, a protest that is going on and there's a reasonable decision made by the police or the fire department or National Guard officials that either certain engagements with, say, counter-protesters or certain actions that are making it unsafe because you have too many people congregated in one area and they ask for people to spread apart or stop doing certain things, that too can give rise to criminal liability.
Huh. How much is reasonableness in the eye of the beholder in that kind of situation?
You know, reasonableness is a central thread that runs through the law. We assess a lot of things for reasonableness, and reasonable conduct is permissible and unreasonable conduct is not. After a quarter century in the law, one thing I can tell you is that reasonable is exactly in the eye of the beholder, but generally it's assessed from the perspective objectively of, we use the reasonable individual as kind of our benchmark, right? So we get in a really circular argument, but it's kind of what most of us would see as appropriate and responsible under the circumstances. So I think when you talk about a reasonable public safety order, if law enforcement simply said to an otherwise peaceful protest, you guys need to go home, that would not be a reasonable public safety order. If a certain number of protesters were pressing in to a confined space such that it's making it not safe for the protesters themselves, or if they were confronting a group of counter-protesters and there was some sense that the situation could become violent and they asked them, hey, can you guys go to opposite sides of the street, for example, that's something that most of us would see as a reasonable order because you're not really prohibiting or interfering with the right of those folks to express, but you're encouraging them and asking them to do it in a way that reflects the safety and protects the safety of everyone involved and gives everyone involved an opportunity to engage in their own expression.
So, of course, we're talking lawful, unlawful, but another question I have is, what's the role of civil disobedience in situations like we're seeing today?
You know, civil disobedience is a really deeply ingrained idea in American society. It goes back to Thoreau and beyond. I mean, Thoreau wrote about the idea of civil disobedience. When we talk about civil disobedience, I think at a philosophical level, what we're really talking about is the idea that some laws or some circumstances in society are so unjust or inappropriate that it is not appropriate to live under that law, that there is a higher responsibility that you as a citizen or as an individual are called to. So, you know, whether it was Thoreau and his essay, whether it was Martin Luther King leading nonviolent protest in the South against segregation, it is saying that these laws are so unjust or inappropriate that we're not going to follow them. One of the real questions then becomes what happens. You certainly saw that in protests against segregation, that folks would carry the consequence of violating the law. They knew they were going to go to jail, but it was the attention that was drawn to the reality of thousands of people being arrested and subjected to laws that were fundamentally unjust that drew our attention to that, and we decided as a society no more. I think one of the real problems becomes that people refer to a lot of things as civil disobedience, and it's not intended philosophically to be simply a protection to do what you want. It is something more than that.
So these ongoing protests around the nation call for broad policing reform, and some matters are being introduced at the federal level. However, policing is a state and local area of authority. This puts national candidates in a tricky situation. Joining us to examine that situation were Lisa Hager and David Wiltsy, professors of political science at South Dakota State University.
Lisa, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
David, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So I want to start off with, we are seeing a few measures being introduced at the federal level. I'm not sure who wants to start. Maybe whoever can answer the question of just what are we seeing introduced at that federal level to start with?
That's probably best for Lisa.
I think what we're seeing first and foremost is just a number of politicians coming out talking about, you know, what they see being an issue here with police brutality and whatnot. And so, that's kind of like the bigger narrative mm-hmm. that we're seeing at this particular time and whatnot. I would have to look a little bit more into some of the specifics. I've been working on a variety of other research projects at the moment, so I'm mm-hmm. a little bit behind, I will admit that, and whatnot. But more of the federal government trying to say that they are, in fact, looking to try to do what they can on this particular issue, which has been relatively limited in the past because, like you said, opening the show, there is this being more of a state issue and a local issue. And so there's limits to what the federal government can even do. And so what has generally happened in the past is the Law Enforcement Misconduct Act allowed for the federal government essentially to sue local police agencies that engaged in some patterns and practices of unconstitutional policing. So anything that would be like a stop and frisk that seems more racially motivated or something like that. And so this was something that the Obama administration used extensively in order to deal with a variety of different issues, such as the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. But we actually saw that that's not being used very frequently, if at all, during the Trump administration. So again, what they're doing is really returning that power to the states.
Hmm. Yeah, and we've also seen a lot of federal monies being sent down to states and localities for things like community policing and other projects. Again, they can't tell cities to do this, but they can try to entice them through financial incentive. And I know that Joe Biden announced some measure like that that he would like to put in place once he comes into office if he's elected. But again, they're trying to step around this constitutional restriction of what is federal domain and what is state and local matter.
Mm-hmm. David, can you kind of expand on the situation for us? Because as mentioned in the intro, with such a local decision, like we've said, particularly for an issue that seems especially at top of mind for Democrats, how is Joe Biden handling this as it unfolds?
Well, he seems to be trying to split the difference between a lot of the active talk you see on kind of the left side of the Democratic Party about defunding and reorganizing police in the same way that happened in Camden, New Jersey, and a few other localities. He's not really talking too much about that, but he is, you know, moving towards other more popular models of policing. And again, it seems to be largely centered on just providing the funding that is necessary for these kinds of transformations to take place. But it can't be mandated from the top, or at least it's very difficult to do that constitutionally. Mm-hmm. So they have to lay out a set of incentives through this kind of funding. But he certainly is not terribly responsive to the more radical elements that are calling for all sorts of just complete restructuring of departments across the country.
Hmm. Lisa, I wonder if you can talk about how, with President Trump still in office, I don't know why I said still with President Trump in office. Yikes! I'm gonna get emails about that. With President Trump in office, and Joe Biden still yet the candidate. If President Trump were to decide to make broad changes, how is that limited? We talked a little bit top down. It's difficult, but talk a little more about some of those limitations.
Right. Yeah. So, like I said, there's just very few mechanisms available to the federal government, and just like what Dave was saying, that allow for the federal level to really do much about these issues. So they are going to have to try to create some incentives relating to funding and whatnot. And anything that would be mandated would likely be challenged by states in the courts. And I could see that being an issue that would reach the Supreme Court. And generally, they have tended to be more supportive of states' rights as of late, and even just kind of in general, kind of starting more with the Rehnquist Court in the late 80s and to the mid-2000s until Chief Justice Roberts took over as Chief Justice. So I could see any sort of mechanism that would come across as more forceful being declared unconstitutional and a violation of states' rights. And that, you know, kind of goes back to, you know, a lot of times we think that, you know, the president is having a lot of control over all issues, and they do have a substantial amount of power and influence, but at the same time, you know, they are bound by the Constitution, so issues such as the 10th Amendment and states' rights, but also just with respect to the federal government themselves, they're not always able to get their way. And so if we are looking at political science research on presidents, one of the key books by Richard Neustadt talks all about how presidents have to bargain. And even scholars going forward have really talked about how presidents have to try to encourage or persuade Congress and others to do what they want. So that might even be the states in this particular situation. And so sometimes they're more successful with that than others. And sometimes more lately, it's effective for them to go public if they are looking for there to be change, because they can get the public on board. And then the public can really say, hey, we want this to happen. And these elected officials who do want to stay elected will be more likely to listen.
And honestly, from just a purely political perspective, there's no incentive whatsoever for President Trump to even begin to enact any kinds of reforms here in the direction that folks on the left would like. I mean, he has always seen police unions as one of his power bases, and he's always been very accommodating to these folks. Hmm. So he'd be very loath to move in any direction that would run counter to the interests of the police unions in this country.
Hmm. Talking about other authorities, I have in my notes this idea of consent decrees, something that I'm not super well informed about. If something like that plays out, what are some of the limitations of that on a reform basis?
Well, I can take that. So in general, I really don't expect that to even occur during the Trump administration, because that requires the U.S. government to sue local police agencies that are engaging in some sort of unconstitutional policing tactics and things like that. And so just currently what we've seen out of the Trump administration, I don't necessarily see that they're going to be doing that, even if that's just based on how they viewed the current consent decrees that were in place in the Department of Justice when he did take office. And at the time, his first Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, you know, really was, again, talking about how this is a state's issue. So states and local governments need to be dealing with this, not the federal government. So they were not interested in intervening. You know, that's something that we've seen out of the Trump administration, really being more interested in promoting states' rights. So I don't necessarily see this occurring. Now, if we get to November and Joe Biden is elected, we could see that occurring more as we see his presidency start.
Mm-hmm. How are we seeing
and
this? Go ahead, David.
I think, just to build on what Lisa was saying about Sessions and the Trump administration, I don't think they have entered into a single consent decree with another police department, and they've largely let these agreements atrophy and go unenforced from almost day one.
Hmm. How are we seeing this climate play out on the congressional level? Of course, recently we had members, Democratic leadership, kneel in the Capitol with the cloth and everything. Some folks seeing that as a sign of solidarity. Other folks looking at it as pandering with no real action behind it, a purely symbolic move. How are we watching this? If it's not necessarily an executive issue, how is it playing out in Congress? Maybe David, we'll start with you on that and then go to Lisa.
Yeah. Well, it is largely symbolic simply because of the divided control of the Congress. But these kinds of symbols are very important. In reference to the kente cloth, that was something that the Congressional Black Caucus asked leadership to wear. Mm. So this kind of symbolism is important. And I don't think anyone really expects anything to be done between now and the next Congress on this, simply because of the divided nature of government right now. But symbolically, I think this is important, particularly when we're going through a period of time where a huge portion of the electorate feels that they are absolutely disenfranchised, that their voices aren't being heard. This is an important symbol to say, yeah, we are hearing you and we're listening. And we will take this up if we, if we are put in power come January.
Lisa,
building off of what Dave was saying, that's exactly right. It's important to state your position on this particular issue, and what we're seeing is them doing that. The other thing is, they're able to show their constituents and the nation at large that they do care about this issue and actually place blame on the fact that they are in a divided government situation as to why they are unable to enact any sort of meaningful change in this area. And so that's something that then can be used when it's time to really hit the campaign trail pretty hard and try to get people out to the polls.
Mm-hmm. And this is also something that is fairly cost-free for the Democratic leadership. When the American people vote and when they are making their decision about whom to vote for, it is largely retrospective, and they are focused on the presidential party. They don't pay a lot of attention to who's in control of which chamber of commerce, of Congress, and they simply vote on the status quo based on their sense of how the president is handling it. Hmm. So it's something that they can do that is symbolically important, and they're probably not going to have to bear any real cost for doing so.
Right. I'll look at how local leaders are in conversation with congressional leaders, because the other day Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Tenhaken tweeted that defunding the police will not be part of the Sioux Falls conversation as they look at strategies to be a safe and equitable city. Got some pushback with that tweet, and then later yesterday Senator Thune retweeted the mayor and said that he agrees, saying, "I can't wrap my mind around this, calling for more police training mixed with calls to defund the police," and then saying less funding means less money for training programs, less desirable salaries, less selective recruitment pool, and all of that. So I wonder if you can just kind of talk about how representatives are looking to local leadership and how local leadership is looking to communities, and how sometimes those wires cross between the ideas for solutions and others?
Yeah, well, a lot of these ideas are still being hashed out, mm-hmm. and just the labels. We haven't quite agreed on exactly what defund the police means. Mm-hmm. And as time wears on, as reformers really begin to carefully consider and look at different models across the country that have done a lot of restructuring, these will begin to clarify. And again, places like Camden, New Jersey, they spend less on their policing now, but they've shifted a lot of the spending from high-dollar equipment and other things towards more training and just a different frame of mind for police officers. So it's, we're kind of in that stage where we're all ascribing our own definition of what defund means and trying to make the best short-term political capital out of it. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to what these folks are saying right now. Mm-hmm. But as ideas begin to solidify, as more and more police departments across the country begin this process, and Minneapolis has taken some very important steps in that direction right now, I think we will begin to see a better idea of what all this means to an individual police department as they begin this process of reform. Hmm.
Lisa, anything to add?
I think basically what you're seeing from the mayor of Sioux Falls and Senator Thune is just, they're trying to wrap their heads around these possible reform ideas. And it sounds like for the most part, they're fairly on the same page. And so I think that's something to be expected, obviously, in a state that's the size of South Dakota in terms of population, but also where there tends to be one political party that's fairly dominant. And so they're probably going to have similar views on these sorts of issues. But I think, like Dave was saying, what's going to be most effective is seeing what other locales are doing on these sorts of issues. Let them kind of be the experimenter, so to speak, and then they can lead other states and cities who maybe don't feel like it's at the... I mean, it's not like it's not a top priority for them, but, maybe they haven't had some sort of large-scale issue where they feel like they need to reform immediately. They have that luxury to wait and see how others are doing things and then kind of follow in their leadership.
And there's going to be a lot of asymmetries here, mm-hmm. from state to state, city to city. And again, it's just because the federal government can't really come in and direct this reform process. It has to come from states and from localities themselves.
Now, this discussion on policing continues as we take a look at issues locally with Dakota Political Junkies. That, along with some news involving members of the South Dakota Legislature. Enjoy.
Our political junkies this time around are John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. Welcome back, John.
Thanks, Jackie. Glad to be here.
And in Vermilion, Michael Card, associate professor of political science at the University of South Dakota. Welcome back, Professor Card.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Jackie. Greetings, John.
Yes, greetings.
I want to start off with last night, Mayor Paul Tenhaken sent out a tweet. I've got the tweet in front of me, so I'll go ahead and read it word for word. The initial tweet says, "As we move forward in Sioux Falls with strategies to ensure we remain a safe and equitable city, the dialogue of defunding the police will not be part of our conversation. Our administration is working toward realistic solutions with lasting impact, not political puffery." And then about an hour later, he expanded on about ideas about how well-funded police departments would equal better and more training for officers, better technology, stronger school resource programs, things like that. He ended with, "If you have ideas for the community, send them to me at this email address." And then some of the more sarcastic replies being like, "Here's my idea, defund the police." So I'm not sure who wants to kick off with this one. Maybe I'll start with you, Mike. How does this play in as we're thinking locally about the rhetoric around defunding / disbanding / abolishing the police?
Well, to give credit, there's been a lot of criticism about police misbehavior, but we also know that that isn't all police activity. Police have a tremendously difficult job. You don't know whether the next moment is going to put yourself on a trajectory that will prove to be the toughest challenge of your professional career, or it's going to be as simple as putting on your shoes in the morning. And what we've seen in the news most recently are several graphic images of misbehavior by individuals who happen to be police. But we've also seen other people engage in similar behaviors that identifies a certain amount of bias. I think the issue of defunding the police is probably a representation that goes a little far in saying that we need to abolish police. I just can't see that. I'm more on the line. I think Mayor Ten Hagen is capturing that by saying we will always need public safety personnel. We will always need someone to go after the truly bad people and protect the rest of us.
John Hunter, where do you weigh in on this conversation?
Well, Mike is right. It's an incredibly complicated topic. And there are good police departments and bad police departments, as well as people within those departments. Just like any occupation, I suspect there is good public radio hosts and not so good public radio hosts. So what I think most people would like to do is to try to find out where's the best ones? Where's the model police departments, the ones with the best practices, the ones with the most success, with the least violence, the least claims against them, and so forth, and try to emulate those. I do think that defunding is the concept of it is a frustration, and the fact that so many people are outraged by these bad actors, as they were called, the people who did the terrible things, that it's a frustration reaction. It said, look, let's just cut out the whole thing. It's probably not a responsible thing to do for public safety, but the frustration is real, and it's broad, and it's widespread, and I think people are trying to, at the moment, think of anything that they can to improve the situation.
Mm-hmm. I had a conversation with USD's Dean of the Law School, Neil Fulton, yesterday a little bit about this idea of defunding the police, and his comment, which is I've seen echoed in a wide variety of posts and articles and things like this, is that when we say or when people say defund the police, it's not so much about, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, it's not so much putting that funding down to zero. It's about reallocating some of those funds to other community resources and things like that to try to solve some of the issues that we're seeing. A critique of Mayor Ten Hagen's tweet I saw last night was, when you ask a community for input, for ideas of solutions, and one rises above, is it the best idea to immediately call that unreasonable, rather than continuing a conversation? I guess John Hunter, and then we'll circle back to Mike, but start with John. How do you see, leaders, especially locally, really grappling with some of these ideas?
Well, I think most good public leaders do look for input, but it isn't necessarily this particular situation, and not necessarily a vote of the social media respondents. In other words, the people who respond most to in one manner or another is not necessarily how the leadership would respond. I think good leaders listen, evaluate, take the best ideas, try to implement them, discuss with others, and do that. But it isn't a social media response campaign that is what would happen. We'd ask our leaders to be thoughtful, to accept public input, to weigh all the circumstances and make the best decision that they can.
Mike, how about you?
Well, I think John is right on target with this, that it's a quick solution to a problem that is deeply buried within human beings, is we have a tendency to bias, and that bias occasionally shows up in situations that get out of control. You know, how do we teach each other and train each other to slow down and not appeal to our lesser nature that's being fed by adrenaline or fear, and to slow down and think this is another human being, and create our policies in line with that.
Mm-hmm. I want to kind of continue on in a similar vein as we're seeing. Sioux Falls had its large march and demonstration. Time makes no sense to me anymore. A week, 2 weeks ago, Rapid City has been seeing several days in a row of protests. As this continues on, Mike, what are some of the, I guess, responses to these demonstrations? I know Vermilion has had a couple marches as well, and I've seen some interesting articles with headlines about how even in predominantly Republican and rural areas like South Dakota, we are seeing some of these marches pop up as well. So how are we seeing this conversation continue beyond the initial spark a couple weeks ago, Mike?
Well, I think there's a couple different issues, one of which is the entire issue of protesting, and then the other issue is one of civil disobedience, which, again, you had a conversation with Dean Fulton yesterday. And then the third one is actual unlawful behavior that's not based on normative values of protesting the nature of the law, which is what civil disobedience is. That's where we tend to get into words like riots and true civil disobedience. Well, we get into notions of riots, throwing rocks at individuals, which is an assault, and other crimes. So I think if we're looking at peaceable protests, I think people aren't so worried about that. The danger is that when you have an unorganized protest, there are lots of different people join in, some of which see it as an opportunity that there's an opportunity to loot. There's an opportunity to strike back at what you perceive to be the enemy, which may be the police. It may be a business owner. And, you know, to some extent, the more that protests can be organized and free speech allowed, the better off we're going to be. And I think as we're seeing it most recently, there's been more civil protests. I don't know if that's what you were looking for, but that's what I see going on is for the most part, if we can organize a protest, the organizers are able to create a forum for people to speak their mind. There is no unlawful activity for the most part, unless it's civil disobedience where people are willing to be arrested, and that arrest is to protest what's viewed to be as the immoral nature of the law itself.
John, what sorts of things have you seen up in your neck of the woods?
Well, we believe there's going to be a demonstration Friday here about this topic. And again, Brookings had them, and there's a variety of South Dakota cities doing this, and I think probably on a smaller scale of every state in the country. But protests have a, I don't know if my words are going to be quite right, but a grand American tradition. Protesting is guaranteed by the Constitution. It's a great way, I think, to express concern with leadership. You know, I guess throwing tea in the harbor probably was in their category number three, Mike. costing someone some money. But I'm glad Americans have the right to express their feelings, and I'm glad they're doing it in this case. And this deep-seated problem is being protested because it's a deep-seated problem, and I'm glad for that. The more, the better, I think, then leaders, elected officials, and others will listen the more these kinds of things are. Then you get to stage two that Mike was describing, where, you know, civil disobedience, you lie down on the street and you're blocking traffic and you get arrested and so on, you know, no monetary harm to a business. And then this third one where you're taking a claw hammer to the cash register at Target. I mean, there's these different kind of levels, but boy, I think for a problem that we have in this, at least perceived by Americans, that protesting, I think, is a valuable American right, and I'm glad people are doing it.
I want to shift gears now, and I'm going to conflate a couple stories because we're short on time, but I'll outline them and we can discuss as we need. The first story being Wenzel Cummings quitting as the legislature's code counsel after just 1 year on the Legislative Research Council. A pretty stark condemnation of the way that LRC staff are treated by our state legislature. We heard some of that in SDPB's Lee Strubinger's story at the top of the hour. And then also in legislative news, the legislature's State Tribal Relations Committee apparently had offered to help the governor's office as it was working with the tribal checkpoints related to COVID, and in that same meeting saying they were never really involved in that process. And I think what I'm getting at with bringing these two up at the same time is it sounds like things are a little rough in the state house. I mean, John, what do we make of these situations that seem to be coming up fairly often?
Well, if I may address the LRC directly, and I'm not an insider, so, but the LRC has had this, this is not brand new issue for them. This has happened for a while. Legislators have at times been abusive of the LRC, and it shouldn't happen. I mean, the LRC has its role defined very carefully and in a nonpartisan way, and they have done good work. You know, Jim Fry was head of that for a long time, a man I admired, some legislators have taken and not treated the LRC well. So I believe this is I'm saddened that they have a resignation after a short time, but in another way I'm glad it's a issue that may be addressed by this. At least it sounded like when the executive board listen to this, they appeared to be eager to repair that relationship.
Mm-hmm. And Mike, what do you have to add about either one of these stories, either the LRC's treatment by the legislature or this idea that the State Tribal Relations Committee wasn't as closely involved in the checkpoint issue as they would like?
Well, and it's not clear from the news reporting that our governor has met with the tribal president. Mm-hmm. So it seems as though, and I don't know this, but from what's been reported, is there's been attempts to communicate, but attempts to communicate by letter, not by telephone, not by meeting in person. And we may be getting the legislature, which as John was intimating, has been in a battle with itself on partisan reasons and between the two chambers for at least a decade, as well as with the governor's office. And those fights show up in interesting places. And that may be the governor wants a quick resolution to the issue and there isn't one. And perhaps involving the State Tribal Relations Committee wasn't going to allow a quick resolution, which seemed to be the governor's desire by writing to the state's congressional delegation, to the BIA, and to the president to try to get a quicker resolution. But as a guest that was on this program about a week ago was Professor Emeritus Frank Pommersheim, that indicated, well, the law seems pretty clear that the tribe is within its rights to act as it is. There isn't a quick resolution, and certainly there isn't a quick resolution without conversation. But as you noted, Jackie, everything's blending together. There's so much happening, it's difficult to have a reasonable timeline on when did that occur? Oh, that was a week ago.
Right.
Oh, boy, it seems like forever. Right? And so I think we just need to slow down and think, what's the most important priority that we're dealing with today? Hmm. And I would suspect that if we can slow down and think, you know, how do we really solve this problem? We can address some of these issues. Maybe that makes me a 61-year-old Pollyanna, but it seems that that's what we need to do. You know, and again, part of it's because the unusual times that we're in just obliterate our sense of time.
We've been having a number of conversations on the pandemic's consequences for the food supply chain. This week, we took a look at the economic impacts of meat plant closures. Everett Vandersloo joined us for that conversation. He's a professor of economics at South Dakota State University.
Professor Vandersloo, welcome back to In the Moment.
Glad to be here. Good afternoon.
So SDPB has heard throughout these conversations from ranchers and pork producers and Smithfield workers, congressional delegates, and among all these people, there really seems to be a consensus that the meat supply chain really lacks resiliency. So as a sort of overview for us, what can you tell us about the economic factors that are at play here prior to the pandemic and why the system turned out to be so vulnerable?
Yeah, well, I think it is a very, it's kind of a complex question. Of course, aside from the physical conditions, which I think you have already reported on, and actually the New York Times today has a very nice kind of overview that talks about some of the physical conditions in the meat packing plants, and it has to do with, you know, it's difficult to keep people 6 feet apart, and that the industry relies very strongly on cheap labor, and that the speeds are high, and that sort of thing. So it's a system that is built for efficiency, and that's not just the packing plants themselves, but it's the entire system, and that showed up, that was illuminated by COVID. You could say, especially in the hog industry, where it takes 22, 26 weeks or so, about half a year for these pigs to be raised from farrow to finish, and then they're ready for market. And then if with that just in time delivery, so to speak, if something doesn't work out, then these pigs need to be kept longer, and then they get too fat for consumers to, that's not the optimal type of weight that they want, and it creates all sorts of other difficulties. Also, in the beef industry, the timing is not quite as pertinent because it is more easy. It's easier to keep these animals a little bit longer. So those are kind of the physical factors. But then, you know, on the economic side, which is really what you're asking me about, we have it's become very clear that these plants are bottlenecks in the supply chain, and that can create an issue. It works wonderful and great if under normal circumstances, which we had been used to until COVID hit, of course, the system was very efficient. But there have been long questions about, you know, why do we have such a concentration in the industry where it's just a few packing companies that control much of the processing, especially on the beef side. But it's also true in the with regards to other meats as well. So then the question is, Why is that consolidation happening? And, you know, we have a term in economics that's called economies of scale that basically says that if you double the inputs, you get more than double the output. So, and that relates to costs also. That means that, you know, per unit of output, you can produce more cheaper if you have a big plant versus a small plant. So the question that has long been asked by economists is the industry really subject to economies of scale, or is there something else going on? And that something else that may be going on is what they have been accused of for a long time is, of course, that they have a lot of market power. We call it, you know, an oligopsony kind of thing. That means just a few companies that operate in the industry and that basically can subversely or tacitly or just kind of make backdoor agreements about what prices they will pay out. And those are some of the basic economic issues. On the one hand, you know, is it maybe true that there's economies of scale going on, meaning simply that large plants operate more cheaply, or is it because of market power? So those are the two, you know, the two big choices. But then also, of course, we have other things like the industry relies heavily on labor and on the meat side especially, and the non-meat packaged food tends to be much more automated. So we've seen a lot of automation in other food packing industry, but not so much on the meat side. And with this COVID, you know, we can argue, well, a robot isn't going to get sick. but with a heavy reliance on labor standing closely together, if people get sick, then that creates a huge weakness, of course. And then, of course, we have this just-in-time delivery system, and maybe not as important for the United States, but it is a globally integrated food supply system that relies heavily on a relatively weak transportation and that kind of system. So those are some of the main economic drivers, I think.
Right. And to your point about whether or not these plants are really fall under this idea of economies of scale, I've had this question posed to me, and I'll pose it to you, whether or not the answer is just to have more smaller plants instead of such, you know, just a few really large plants. That way, if one of them goes down to a virus outbreak or something like that, it's not as much of a hazard to the supply chain. But what I'm kind of hearing you say is that maybe it has less to do with the resiliency of the system and a little more to do with just the consolidation in the meat industry. Am I kind of tracking with you?
Well, I think it's both these things. Clearly, what COVID has illuminated is that we I think all observers would say we need more resiliency in the system. We need more redundancies, and the argument against that has always been, well, it's we're efficient the way we are now, but efficiency only lasts until, you know, some sort of a crisis hits, just like we are, we have been exposed to now. So I think there's a good case to be made for building in resiliencies and redundancies that deal with these kinds of issues. So what is probably needed is to look at take a good overall look at the supply chain, and then try to minimize the weakest links in the chain, so to speak. So again, you know, if we have a system that there's different numbers that are being thrown around, but 70-80% of cattle that are processed by just four companies, JBS and Tyson, Cargill and National Beef, one could argue that is, you know, we rely too much on that. And so then if you know, going back to that economies of scale, if truly the industry is not only subject to economies of scale, but there's that market power issue going on, then it isn't necessarily the case that smaller operators would produce more expensively. So there's a case to be made that maybe we need to build a system that or adjust the system so that smaller companies have a bigger role in that process as well. So that's true on the beef side, and as I mentioned, it's also true on the pork side, and lately. What is coming in the news, right, that there have been some legal actions have been taking place, that the Justice Department has issued subpoenas in the beef processing or to beef processing companies, and the chicken industry executives, four of them, were indicted on price-fixing charges. So this is something that has gotten the attention of the Justice Department also. What is going to come out of that, we don't know that, of course, but I would agree with what many observers have said. You know, we have this crisis now. Don't let the crisis pass without, you know, taking a very good look at it and see it as an opportunity to build a better system.
So, of course, also a victim to this crisis, South Dakota farmers and producers, adding to the pandemic, last year's natural disasters with flooding, not to mention international trade disputes. What can you tell us about the potential economic impacts of the pandemic on the state's ag industry?
Yeah, I was reading just last week, from time to time, the Federal Reserve Bank comes out with economic conditions in their district, and we are under the Minneapolis 9th district, and they have a quote there that says the ag sector was under severe stress due to falling prices for some farm commodity and pandemic-related disruptions, such as closing of some of the food processing plants, and that pretty well sums it up. The ag sector is certainly hurting, but I would like to also point out, of course, it is not just farmers that are hurting. Mm-hmm. It's particularly the workers in that industry also.
Right.
And what has been happening, that farmers have been leaning heavily on federal government support. And we can talk some more about that in a moment, but there's been... You know, there have been these huge amounts of money that have been allocated to agriculture to deal with these low commodity prices and these the effect of the trade dispute between the United States and China, but also with regards to other countries. So, and then, of course, you know, if farmers aren't doing well and if the workers in the local communities aren't doing well, then that filters throughout the economies, the local communities. So entire communities are hurt. So it's the entire system that is hurt. And that, of course, is not new, no news to anybody, but we're all aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead and talk to us a little bit, if you will, about how farmers and ag producers are seeing more of that federal relief as opposed to folks actually in the plants.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So I think what we have seen, you know, over the last 2 years, the federal government has provided about $23 billion in payments over the last 2 years. So that's a lot of money. And then in addition to that, with this coronavirus food assistance program, there's an additional $19 billion and $16 billion of that. So that's over 80%, 84% or so is allocated for farmers. So again, you know, the last 2 years, $23 billion plus $19 billion for this coronavirus food assistance program. The majority, far the biggest chunk of that is going to farmers, and we have only $3 billion, as if one can say that, right? These are large amounts of money.
Right.
But I'm trying to put this in context. So only three billion out of the 19 plus 23 billion is for food purchases. So, and just over a billion has actually been contracted. So again, that's for food purchases for consumers. And then the additional 1.8 billion is just optional or dependent on, as the program says, dependent upon program success and available remaining funds. So we're talking over the entire United States, 2 million farmers or so, but we have already about 20 million workers officially being unemployed, plus an additional number of people that are unemployed, and some of those people are in desperate need. So, while all of us, especially here in South Dakota, are in favor of supporting agriculture, we also have to keep in mind the other side of the equation, that the entire food system consists of not only the supply side, but on the demand side also, and that there are large numbers of people who are hurting, and one could make a good case for saying that they ought to be at the table also.
Right. Our time is short, and in just our final few moments, I want to give you an opportunity to walk us through any other thoughts or perspectives you have about our current economic situation as it relates to the food supply chain.
Yeah, well, I've touched on some of the key economic issues, but one thing to keep in mind is with regards to the development of policies. And we have to also learn from history and look at how past policies, how they filtered through, how they reverberated over time. And I was reading up on some articles lately that talked about some of the policies that were implemented in the 1930s. Some of those policies were implemented in such a way that they affected that they benefited some of the larger agricultural producers, and they purposely hurt or they did not benefit some of the small operators, with the specific aim to keep the some of the poor workers on the so that they could be employed by the larger operators. As we keep in mind some of the recent, broader societal turmoil that we all hear so much about in the news, we also maybe we should take a step back and talk about and think about what kind of policies do we really want? Do we want policies that are a quick fix and help the production system, sustain its livelihoods? Or do we also want to design policies that are good for society overall? And I would argue that one can make a strong case for saying that we need some of those policies that also benefit some of the people that we don't necessarily hear too much of, and that are not necessarily invited to sit at the table. But maybe some of these people ought to be sitting at the table because, after all, we're all consumers.
Right.
So bottom line, I would say, is take a look at history and take a look at, some of the lessons that could be learned from history. And maybe we can do better than we did in the past. Mm-hmm. And don't just design policies for the short run, but also for the long run, mm-hmm. I would argue.
Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.